presentations they were about to get. So that's the first time I've ever been introduced that way. But this is also the first men's retreat where I've seen demonstrations of love by seeing what people can hold down when being fed. It's been a revelation for me. Wow, okay. We'll know them by their cuisine, I guess. Yeah, okay. No, it's been fun to be part of this gang. What I'm going to try to do is cut this relatively short so we have more time for a Q&A, because I think that's the most fun for all of us. But let's go through here. I want to correct a slide that I used this morning. You may recall the slide about the government's massive commitments, $1.84 trillion red ink for the 2009, and $14 trillion in the current bailout. Remember that slide? I want to apologize to you because it's an error. I got an email late this afternoon because there's that error is not $14 trillion. There's a correction here. It's not $14 trillion. It's $23.7 trillion as tabulated in the TARP crisis, as tabulated by the official report to the Congress, which I just got my hands on here this afternoon. The report was dated 21 July 2009. And that turns out, if you do some quick arithmetic, that in itself is about $32 million per day from the time that Jesus was born until the year 2000. That is the burden that's being laid on your grandkids by just that one issue, just the TARP layout. You say, Chuck, you're making that up. No. There's a 200-page report you can get on the internet at SIGTARP Government Reports to the Congress, 2009, July 2009. On page 138, there's a chart which tabulates several things, but that among them. So $24 trillion, just for that bailout. That, of course, is irrational, irresponsible, and totally destructive of our financial, our foregoing. So I just thought you might want to correct your notes on that. I was a little naive. I thought it was only $14 trillion. What's $10 trillion among friends, right? Okay. The other thing that kept coming up this afternoon from a number of questions is the Magog invasion. And I didn't cover that because that I thought was familiar ground, and I won't spend a lot of time on it. But there are a lot of questions about it. In Ezekiel 38 and 39, there is, of course, an invasion. And this passage is well known to most Bible buffs for two reasons. The first reason, it's the occasion in which God himself intervenes to quell an ill-fated invasion of Israel by Magog and his allies. And the allies are there listed in Ezekiel 38. Persia, Cush, Put, Libya, Gomer, Togarma, Meshech, and Tubal. And that's one reason. God intervenes openly, dramatically, on behalf of Israel. That's one reason it's so significant biblically. There's a second reason that everybody studies it so much is because the passage appears to anticipate the use of nuclear weapons, rather grammatically, very dramatically, actually. So the identity of Magog is well established. I won't take time here tonight to get into that, but it's well in our materials, well identified. Magog is the biblical name for the people that the Greeks called the Scythians. And they terrified the southern steppes of Russia from Ukraine to China from the 10th century B.C. through about the 3rd century B.C. The Great Wall of China was called the Ramparts of Gog and Magog. That was built to keep Magog out. Didn't quite work. But in any case, that's Magog. And their allies are all listed in Genesis chapter 10. Gomer, Meshech, Tubal, and so forth. And I won't go through all of that here, except to say that they conspire to invade Israel, and God sends hailstones of fire from the sky, and which results in an earthquake that's felt around the world, by the way. So we infer that itself is suggestive of nuclear. There's some other reasons. The lead ally of the bunch is Persia, or as we call it today, Iran. And how interesting it is to see the lineup occurring this way. Everything's in place except one, and that's Turkey. Meshech and Tubal were on the southern coast of Anatolia, which is the eastern two-thirds of what we call Turkey today. Turkey is very much in the middle, and they discovered that they have a whole new piece of leverage in the world scene. Turkey is a member of NATO on the one hand, and yet their future, they realize, is to the east, not the west. And so they're at the moment on the fence, sliding down the razor blade of life, if you will, because here we're going to have some interesting things. I won't go through all that. But the more you know about the passage of Ezekiel 38 and 39, and the more you know about the current geopolitical horizon, the more it seems that this is all getting into position for the Ezekiel 38 and 39 events to occur. Now, why do we say nuclear weapons? Well, because in chapter 39, Ezekiel describes, or should say the Holy Spirit through Ezekiel, points out that the leftover weapons from this would-be engagement supply all the energy needs for Israel for 7 years. Now, if you read the ancient commentators like J.A. Seiss, who published in 1860, and some others, they assumed that that was just some kind of mystical allegory because they couldn't visualize anything burning for 7 years. And we smile at that today. What technology could easily provide all the energy needs of Israel for more than 7 years? And the answer, of course, is nuclear. And yes, there are procedures by which you can convert weapons-grade material into reactor-grade material. It's hard to go the other way. It's easier to go downhill. But Ezekiel goes on to describe the clearing of the battlefield. You know, this fascinates me, by the way, because as a specialist in military science and as a devotee of the Bible for many years, I've always studied biblical battles. All through the Bible, A goes against B, somebody wins or loses, and the story goes on. Only in one case that I'm aware of does the Holy Spirit bother to spend any substantial time on the cleanup after the battle. That's what chapter 39 is. 38 is the deal, and then 39 is the cleanup afterwards, essentially. And in fact, the Holy Spirit goes on to add a lot of interesting details here. You know, I'm convinced, by the way, that the Holy Spirit manages the details in the Bible. Acts 27 has more nautical terms in it than any other place in the Bible. It has enough nautical terms so that you could identify the location of the anchors that Paul cut loose. And Bob Courtney did track them down, and we were there at the Marine Museum in Malta when they were donated, and the four actors. There's enough technical detail in Acts 27 to make that possible. And I am elliptical enough to assume that the reason the details are there is to make the discovery of the etc. Okay, I think the same thing is true of Jabal al-Awla as the real Mount Sinai. It's been very well corroborated. So anyway, in this case, we have so much detail here. I think the Holy Spirit's deliberately trying to get us to understand what's really going on here. Because the Scripture tells us that professionals are hired to clear the battlefield. The King James phrase is, they sever out men of continual employment. Well, I'm taking the liberty of calling them professionals, okay? And they're hired to clear the battlefield. They wait 7 months before entering, and then they clear for 7 months. And they bury what they find east of the Dead Sea. Read that downwind. It doesn't stop there. If a traveler passing through the area finds something that the professionals have missed, he doesn't touch it. He marks the location, lets the professionals come and deal with it. That was written 2,550 years ago. And if you guys have been briefed on NBC warfare, nuclear, biological, and chemical, you know these procedures are very contemporary. But there is a verse, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this because there are other things to talk about, but there is a verse that probably does deserve some comment. That's a subject of some concern to most scholars that have studied this. When you get to verse 6 of chapter 39, God has already in chapter 38 described how he's going to hail stones of fire upon Magog and all his allies on behalf of Israel. When you get to chapter 39, verse 6, there's a recap of this. God says, I will send fire on Magog, okay, and among them that dwell carelessly in the isles or coastlands. And they shall know that I am the Lord. Now, who are these people? It's not Magog. We've already talked about Magog and all his allies. And it certainly isn't Israel, or it would say so. No, it's a third party. It's some third party that somehow has gotten involved here. Okay? And it says that among them, these third party, and it's that some third party involved, and that dwell carelessly in the isles or coastlands. The Hebrew word Iyah for the is translated isles or coastlands. If you look at every place in the Bible, all you can infer, it's some kind of remote, either coastlands or isles, a pleasant place. Where is it? We don't know. It's not identifiable. But what is it? There's just a hint, by the way, but it's reminiscent of, you may remember the movie The 13 Days, which is a documentary, or is a dramatization of the Cuban Missile Crisis. How many have seen that movie or are familiar with it? Okay. Yeah, it's very familiar to me because I happened to be with John Rubel, Assistant Secretary of Defense, that afternoon when John F. Kennedy made his famous speech. And Khrushchev was sending, they were installing missiles down in Cuba, sending ships to supply them, add more of them. And we said, John F. Kennedy said, if we confronted the Soviet Union before the UN on that whole thing on that Monday. But anyway, John F. Kennedy got on the air and announced to the Soviet Union that if any missile is fired anywhere in the Western Hemisphere, it will result in immediate full-scale retaliation against the heartland of the Soviet Union. That's in the speech. You can check it out if you want to look at the documentation. They also quarantined it, and all the world watched for those 13. At the last minute, of course, they finally did turn 1-8, and the whole thing de-escalated. Very much studied on both sides of the Atlantic. And the estimates are that anything less would not have worked. It was an example, it's a classic example of brinksmanship. And it worked. And Khrushchev, at the last minute, backed down. But think about it for a minute. At the time John F. Kennedy made that speech, all the Atlas and Titan silos were fueled and ready. SAC was on station with all the refuelers and the aircraft. If Khrushchev could have his intelligence assets confirm that John F. Kennedy was serious. And on that strength, he did back down at the last minute. But what if some idiot did something stupid? Some technician fired some kind of missile into Central America or something. What would have happened? It would have triggered a full-scale nuclear attack against the Soviet Union and vice versa. I wonder if that is what is hinted at here. I'll send fire upon Magog and among them that dwell carelessly in the isles. Is it possible that as these nations come up against Israel, somebody, possibly the United States, says, don't do that, or else we, and it gets to be a brinksmanship escalation. Except in this case, somebody does something stupid and it results in an exchange. And maybe it's our warheads that are the hailstones of fire that fall upon Magog and his allies. And maybe it's their missiles that deliver an overdue judgment to the United States. And maybe that's one of the reasons that we don't show up in the final end time scenario. It's one of about four or five scenarios that attempt to explain why is the United States not an end time prophecy. The most likely one in front of us is the financial collapse of the United States. That could be one possibility. Another possibility is this exchange scenario that we see going on here. So, the word carelessly, by the way, in the Hebrew is batash, which means in false confidence. When Israel's dwelling securely, same word, batash, it's in a position of false confidence. And likewise, these people, this third party, whoever they are in some sense of false confidence. Okay, just a little tidbit, if nothing else, to generate some questions. The main thing I hope it does, if nothing else, is to send you back to review carefully Ezekiel 38 and your supporting materials for that, because clearly something is brewing on our horizon. It may not be, by the way, even if there's a huge exchange over Iran and Israel, it isn't necessarily Ezekiel 38. But it might be, and we should keep an eye on that, so for what it's worth. But there's another thing that some of the discussions today, this afternoon, reveal that this may be very familiar to you. I won't spend a lot of time on it, but it's something you definitely do need to know. Let me ask you this. How many of you have been briefed on electromagnetic pulses? Okay, it's pretty familiar to you, so I'll go quickly. This is a picture of the Majlis in October 3 years ago, 4 years ago for this October. in which they voted on their nuclear program. Out of the 200, the Majlis is the Iranian parliament, 290 delegates, 247 of them are voting for the program, and they do it by standing and shouting, death to the United States, death to Israel. I think the order of that is very interesting, to understand their mindset. And we could go on about that, but recent hints by the Department of Homeland Security, Americans should prepare for the inevitability of a nuclear event sometime in the future. Notice that word inevitability, not highly likely, inevitable. That's the view, okay? And I'll frankly disclose something to you that's not public known. The Department of Homeland Security's number one priority is the threat of an electromagnetic pulse attack against the United States. So it's quite, but apparently, in general terms, a nuclear event, it's not a question of when, it's a question of when, not if. That's the presumption. Now, what is an electromagnetic pulse? We first really discovered this in 1962 with the Starfish detonation down in the South Pacific. We detonated a 1.6 megaton warhead about 400 kilometers above Johnston Island. 1,400 kilometers away in Hawaii, streetlights were blown out, alarms were tripped, and there was damage to telecommunication facilities. We finally figured out that that was due to an electromagnetic pulse phenomenon of a nuclear device detonated that high in the altitude. When it gets up to a certain height, there's a Compton effect, a peculiar kind of physics, which, among other things, generates a very intense magnetic pulse. And at the same time that happened, navigation was disrupted in Australia for about 18 hours. We never explained how. The Soviets discovered the same thing when they did their high-altitude tests. They had power supply breakdowns. They actually even did damage to not only overhead but buried cables. Because of this when you detonate a nuclear weapon in a very high altitude, the Compton effect causes this huge magnetic pulse to be one of its byproducts. So that's why, by the way, we signed with the Soviet Union, we curtailed high altitude testing. Because we both learned what we felt we needed to know by our respective testing, but it has effects that were widespread, and we backed off, both sides. And that's been honored since. But there was a commission paneled by our Congress of the top 9 scientists that serve the E-ring of the Pentagon. And the commission to assess the threat of the United States, of an electromagnetic pulse. There's no explaining engineers, by the way, why they use a 3-letter abbreviation for a 2-word phenomenon. Electromagnetic is one word, but everybody calls it EMP, okay? Wi-Fi'd it. Let's just understand that engineers are like that, okay? They didn't pass English, but they did well in math and science, okay? An electromagnetic pulse attack. Now, this commission was headed up by William Graham himself, and if you know anything about advanced physics, many of these names are quite familiar to you, and Lowell Wood and the whole gang. So these 9 guys were the commission, and they published their report to the Congress in July of 2004. That was the same month that the 911 Commission published its report, and that's, of course, what the media picked up on, because it had political consequences. This was overlooked by most people. It's on the Internet. You can read it today. And I encourage every one of you to do that. And what's the general gist of it? As Bill Graham would put it in his words, we've always known... I forgot a slide on that. No, I don't. Okay. We've always known that Israel is a one-bomb target. One nuke over Tel Aviv and it's over. What we were shocked to discover is the United States is a one-bomb target. If you were an enemy of the United States and you got your hands on a thermonuclear warhead, what would you do with it? Plant it in a truck downtown Manhattan? That would make a hole. The most useful thing you could do, from your point of view, would be to launch it at a high altitude over the center of the United States. And that electromagnetic pulse would put the United States back to the 19th century. It would destroy telecommunications. You'd lose the power grid. You'd lose sanitation and water supply and food supply to the cities. Not for a few hours. You would lose anything with a microcircuit connected to a long wire. You'd lose permanently. You don't lose telecommunications for 6 hours. You lose telecommunications, period. You don't lose power to the metropolitan cities for a few hours. You lose power to the metropolitan cities. We learned in Katrina, how do you pump gasoline out of a gas station if there's no power to pump the gas? How do you send an ambulance downtown if there's gridlock because the signals aren't working? You suddenly begin to realize as you analyze this that it would be disastrous. And it's not a question of... See, the other thing you learn is it, whatever recovery plan you have in mind has to be in place before this happens. Because once this happens, you lose the ability to put in a recovery plan. So it has all kinds of implications, and that's what the report deals with, and I encourage you to take a look at it. Take the United States and launch a thermonuclear warhead 40 miles up in the sky, and it'll generate a magnetic pulse that'll reach both coasts at an adequate altitude and an adequate kind of warhead. And that's what the report deals with. And Israel's known, as I said, I forgot that I had a slide on this. Okay. Let me give you an alternative scenario that's not quite so dramatic. Let's assume that you could get a container ship, an unmarked container ship, within 200 miles of the eastern seaboard. And you get that, you bring in that container ship, and let's assume, you can't get too close, so let's assume you get to about 200 miles out, where you pop a container and fire an off-the-shelf Sahab 3 medium-range ballistic missile. You don't care about accuracy. All you care is about altitude. And you get that thing. You can't get that thing over the center of the United States, but you could probably make it to Indianapolis just to pick a target. And you don't get the whole thing, but you get a pretty good coverage from there. Okay? To give you a feeling for how significant that is, let's take a look at the United States at night and get a feeling for the population density. That circle of impact would account for about 70% of the U.S. population would be without power, without water, without sanitation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Interesting. Well, that's what Ahmadinejad is practicing. On the Caspian Sea, he is firing Sahab 3s from container ships, and just regular warheads, and he detonates them at altitude. James's intelligence people have concluded that what they believe he's doing is practicing an EMP attack. That's not my conclusion. That's their inference. Kind of exciting. He is on a path to get nuclear capability. And the people who are nervous about that is not just Israel. They obviously are. The United States has cause to be concerned for obvious reasons. It may surprise you to know that the Arab Muslim nations are concerned. Why? Because they're Sunnis. And they're uncomfortable with Iran emerging as a super nuclear power. So when our friend Obama runs off to France and runs off to Russia, one of the speculations is he's trying to put together a coalition to make an attack on Iran a bona fide UN attack. He's doing what Bush should have done, in a sense, to go against Iran. Why? Because if he can pull that off, he will be the hero to all the Muslim nations to neutralize Iran. By that one move, he not only makes his points with all the Muslim nations, he also can turn on Israel and say, now you owe me one. Interesting. This guy may not be as stupid as some of us think he is. So, and Ahmadinejad, in any case, is committed to creating the global disruption that will bring in the 12th Imam. That's his game plan. That's his calling to the God he worships, that he takes seriously. And who knows that Obama might even help make that dream a reality. Okay, that's the Issachar part of the evening, all right? Let's talk about something else that a lot of you have been asking me about. I'm responding here mostly to a lot of the dialogue this afternoon. Proverbs, in the book of Proverbs, twice you find this verse, in 22:3 and 27:12. The prudent man foreseeth evil and hideth himself, but the simple pass on and are punished. Somebody asked me here earlier today, you know, what's our obligation for stewardship? Well, it springboards at least from this, if not a lot of other passages. Are we together so far? Okay, that leads to what we call, for lack of another name, the vortex strategy. Okay? Our times are uniquely uncertain. We don't know. It's impossible to predict what's going to happen. We know something's going to happen. We don't know whether it's hyperinflation. That's one threat. That's the scary one. My grandparents had a restaurant. They sold the restaurant to retire. When the escrow was open, there was enough to retire on. When the escrow closed, they got enough to buy a loaf of bread. A loaf of bread in 1920 Germany cost 1 mark. A loaf of bread in 1923 Germany cost 760 million marks for a loaf of bread. Hyperinflation, famous. It's one of 24 examples in Greece and Russia. There have been a lot of others in recent times. So hyperinflation, what's scary about hyperinflation, it comes upon you suddenly. Deflation happens, it's a slowly continuing trend. Inflation is generally a gradual increasing trend. Except what can happen, it can get to a point where it feeds on itself. And when it feeds on itself, it gets into what they call hyperinflation. So it escalates. And it takes that path in a matter of weeks, not months or years. And that is the terror that lies behind the scenes, behind Bernanke and all the rest of it. The other thing, of course, is depression. Hyperinflation or depression. We don't know which one's going to be. What about what kind of logistic upheavals are we going to be facing? See, the optimum strategy under conditions of uncertainty is mobility. In the military, if you're facing uncertainty, you want mobility. You don't want a Maginot line. All kinds of classic examples which argue for flexibility as your primary posture. Well, in financial terms, mobility is liquidity. That's what you're after. You're not only want to get into a safe currency, you also want to try to be flexible. Flexibility is what is the strategy that usually wins under conditions of uncertainty. Well, so what is the vortex strategy in these days? It has 4 steps. I'll save you the whatever $15 or whatever we're charging there, because we're out of them anyway. Okay. What's the first step? The first step is lower your cost of living. Simple, obvious, you can't argue it for a number of reasons I'll come to. The second step is to get out of debt. The third step is to guard your liquidity. And the fourth is the most important I'll leave that for last. Lower your cost of living. Don't count on increases in your income. In fact, one of your biggest uncertainties is the continuation of the income you've already got. So if you have a certain income, the chances are your expenses are probably a little higher than that. Read that credit cards or whatever, right? So the first step in your survival plan is to reduce your expenses in a reduced budget so that you have a portion to keep. So the portion of what you get home is yours. It doesn't go out the window for whatever indulgences we allow ourselves. And by the way, one of the ways to attack your expense reduction is to make a budget of your time. Where are you spending your time? Is there a boat parked in the driveway that you use twice a year? Is there an RV that you use twice a year or three times? And are there things that you've got capital tied up in that you don't really have time to enjoy? Are there toys you allow yourself that the ones you really do, great, but the ones you don't might be re-examined as a source of reducing not just your capital cost, your expenses and your maintenance and depreciation, you name it. Anyway, that's a basic step one, okay? Step two, you use that delta that you've acquired to get out of personal unsecured debt. I'm not talking about the financing of productive assets. The mortgage on a home, I'm assuming, is a financing of a productive asset. in your business. You finance things. It's a productive asset. Different analysis. I'm talking about unsecured personal debt. Get out of it. Debt is a presumption on the future. God doesn't like us to presume. Debt is a presumption. Debt is contrary to God's plan for your life. God uses finances to help give you direction. Going into debt is a sidestepping of what he may be trying to tell you. A borrower is slave to the lender. Believe it. The rich ruleth over the poor, the borrower serveth the lender. I didn't make that up. It's in Proverbs 22 and a lot of other places. Use the increments from step one to repair step two. Refinance variable. Don't be in a variable rate mortgage. If you're in a variable rate mortgage, you're asking for trouble. Eliminate credit card debt. It is vastly more expensive than you have probably ever done the math to figure out. It's, you know, a 30% kind of commitment if you're not careful. Establish and control your budget as if your life depended on it. Why? Because it does. It does. Okay, that gets us to step three. Well, boy, now I'm out of debt. What do I do? Guard your liquidity. Okay? Once debt is under control, you use margin from step one to establish reserves, real reserves. And you diversify that among different asset classes. Well, that means I buy six or seven, you know, Solomon says six or eight things, right? No, we're not talking about six or eight stocks in your portfolio. We're talking about different asset classes, equities being one of them, bonds being another. And you can actually define half a dozen choices you want to diversify. Don't put all your commitments into one particular structure. And that has huge mathematical support. It's called diversification. That's a great hedge against risks of all kinds. Maintain your liquidity. Don't try to maximize your earnings. If we're correct, there's going to be huge bargains forthcoming. Don't be caught by what's called in Wall Street the dead cat bounce. We've got what Wall Street would love you to believe is that we've got a little recovery starting. Watch out. That is a trap. In fact, it's called a bear trap for good reason. What you want to do is straddle, if you have liquid, straddle industries, straddle borders, and straddle currencies. Okay? When most people lost about 50% of their portfolios on the Dow Jones, we made 10% profit because we were in cash in New Zealand dollars. It could be just better off. It could have been Australia. But the point is, recognize that those decisions are anticipatable. You can plan for them. And they're relatively predictable. Now there's another aspect that I want to talk about, because it may be important to many of you in this room. You want to get your assets out of reach from your adversaries. Such assets as you have are going to be targets of opportunity. So your first step is to understand who your adversaries are, and they may come from the strangest places. But you need to take precautionary steps before they're needed. Once you're under attack, it's too late. I'll explain what I mean. Guarding your liquidity, we could spend a whole day on that. Asset protection is the name of the game. In our litigious society, there is a lawsuit filed every 10 seconds. And every lawsuit is a roulette wheel. You've never been in a lawsuit in which your attorney tells you you've got a certain win. He will tell you that you got a better than 50-50 or a less than 50-50 chance. Why does he say that? Because the name of the game is too unpredictable, if we're talking about tort law and so forth. So anyone can sue anyone. They do every 10 seconds. Now we're moving into a society where there's going to be a lot of underemployed attorneys. So what they can easily do is go down the court of records, look at the properties, and find some unencumbered property and contrive a grievance against you, throw it into the system, and hope they might pick up something. Okay? I'm not being flippant here. Talk to your attorneys, and they'll tell you this. Every lawsuit is a roulette wheel, and you're playing a game that they've played before and you haven't. So how do you deal with this? The smart people, if you've got significant means, you want to deal in advance with what is called in the trade the unworthy judgment. Someone contrives, slips on your front porch, sues you, ends up with a judgment, shows up with a $10 million judgment against you. And when he rings your doorbell, you say, great, here's my watch. That's all I own. Go away. I don't own anything else. My laptop, my car, whatever, is in trust. Or it's leased. Or it's encumbered in some way that it's not an attractive garner to a judgment. It's your judgment. You want to be protected against the so-called unworthy judgment. How do you do that? By owning nothing. What you don't own can't be taken away from you. And any smart person deals with this very, very... Most corporations are pairs. You have a holding company and an operating company. The operating company doesn't own anything. It all uses what the holding company owns. And if that's done right, you can't sue the holding company. They don't do anything. The operating company, you can sue all you like. They don't own anything. Now, I mean, I'm oversimplifying to get a point across, obviously. Okay. So this gets you into the world of trusts, corporations, foundations, and all that sort of stuff. This that has its origin in English common law, which favors an English common law domicile. Testamentary trusts, inter vivis trusts, living trusts, that is. There's all kinds of trusts, revocable and irrevocable, and they each have their purposes. They have advantages. It speeds up distribution of assets against probate. You don't want your stuff to go through probate. You're going to handle all that through a trust in advance, and it's clean and simple and far better, more protecting your beneficiaries. And they're far more difficult to contest. They're more private than a will, and they're irrevocable. They can be changed. These kinds can be changed any time you change your mind. The irrevocable ones are also powerful in their own way for certain purposes, because you can use the irrevocable ones to reduce your tax liabilities. You can also use irrevocable ones to place assets into the Cook Islands, which has a reputation of totally ignoring U.S. court orders. So you're suddenly in a trade that there's some expertise can be valuable to you. And, of course, all this avoids the time and expense of a probate, which is what you want to avoid anyway. They have some disadvantages. They typically cost anywhere from a few hundred dollars to a couple of thousand, depending on how complicated they are. They're not free. They also require administration and maintenance. They're not zero. So there is a cost to these, but not a great one if it's done right. But it also can lead you to a mismanagement situation if you haven't got a successor trust. It requires attention. You can't just ignore them. You've got to keep an eye on them year to year. So tax and creditor considerations may favor an irrevocable trust. They're the most powerful kinds if you don't use them properly. You need to create it, first of all. You've got to trust trustors, the creators of them, and trustees are usually the same. Successor trustees could be individuals or institutions, and there's advantages to each. You need to understand that. You have to designate beneficiaries, and then you transfer the assets out of your name as an individual and into your name as a trustee. Boy, is that powerful. Limited partnerships can also serve the equivalent purposes, but they must be very carefully drafted. Title documents transferring the assets are crucial, and you have to do this a year in advance. So if you do all of this, it'll protect you. You won't be really protected until a year passes. Because once a year goes by, it's considered past tense. And if it's less than that, they can argue that this was all a contrived thing to defraud your creditors. If it's done a year ago, that defeats that argument. So if you're worried about this kind of thing, you need to do it now so that you have the protection starting at, say, a year from now. You got to avoid any appearance of fraudulent conveyance, of trying to avoid creditors. And that's the way you do it, by having this all cast in concrete well in advance of a dispute. There's estate planning trusts where multiple trusts where you can save a lot of your tax money if you do these properly. Now, it's difficult to do when you got a changing situation, as we have obviously coming down the pike here, but all the more reason to be expert in this area. And irrevocable trusts, there's wealth preservation trusts. That's a trust-free, a tax-free environment for highly appreciated assets. By the way, if you're going to donate to a church, the smartest thing you can donate are highly appreciated assets, not cash. Because by having a highly appreciated asset, you don't get taxed on the uptick. You get full credit for the donation on the uptick. You have to have appraisal, all that sort of stuff. But it's just something else as an aside. And so anyway, if you do this properly, though, in advance, you can protect your assets from creditors without denying your use of them, okay? Something else you should be aware of. There are very, very powerful techniques called charitable remainder trusts. And it has very significant immediate and accounting benefits. The use of the assets are retained until the death of the owner and or a spouse. The remaining assets then go to a designated charity. So after you and your wife die, whatever it is we're talking about would go to, say, the church. The advantage of it is you get your tax deduction now. And you still have the use of those assets through your life and your wife's life, be it property or what have you. And these strategies can also be supplemented with life insurance. So the whole thing works cleanly, simply. You still enjoy all the benefits of what you have for a lifetime. And yet at the same time, you get the benefit of having it donated to a deductible charity. But the other thing I'm going to suggest you do some homework on is internationalize. Explore the use of offshore trusts. And the role of Liechtenstein was famous for this, but there's a lot of other jurisdictions that are just as well. And they're private, they're invisible, they're sound, but they are expensive. You have to hire the right people to get those set up properly. Use international bank accounts. And there is a disclosure issue, and there are places that you're protected there. There's also, yet the accessibility in today's world can be immediate anywhere in the world. You can look at some of the Visa cards around here and discover they're not U.S. Visa cards. They're drawing on account in London or wherever. Foreign life insurance, fascinating vehicle for estate planning. Foreign life insurance, why? Because it's a contract, not a bank account. No disclosure requirements. And it can be done in Swiss francs, which has its advantages. They're invisible, and they have all other kinds of advantages. Passports, by the way. Do you have current passports for each member of your family individually? Not a collective for all of you. Separate one for each member. Do you have one? Doesn't take long to get it, but it may be when you need it, you may need it more quickly than you can get one. Having one and keeping it current, they're usually issued for, 10 years at a time. Have one and have it in a safe place because it's just another option. Your whole game is to create options for yourself. That's called survival. Understand there's all different forms of ownership. Corporations are simple and private, but there are tax consequences. You need to know how that operates. Limited partnerships are powerful, but they do require continual legal supervision usually. The main point is, gang, each one of you this is directed to, I don't know what your means are, but I'm going to say you need to have a plan. And that plan should be done in consideration you will probably be under attack. You probably won't know where the attack is going to be coming from. But you and your family are going to be under attack. You know spiritually they are, because Satan's, you can probably drown me in anecdotes confirming that issue. But that can take many forms. Medical, of course. Legal is another one. Do your own background reading and homework. Use an attorney. Now, the kind of attorney you want to use for these things is a specialist in asset protection. A general practice attorney may not really have much bankruptcy experience. Chapter 7, Chapter 11. That kind of attorney is a specialist. And he'll represent either side, creditor or debtor, that's fine. But he knows that world and how to win at it. That's the kind of guy you need to set up your trusts. Be diligent with the continuous maintenance of this. Give yourself a schedule where you review these things, certainly at least annually, if not more frequently. Keep an eye on them, look them over, and keep them current. But there's some related topics here, and that's your spiritual portfolio. What's your personal armory? Have you done a careful study of Ephesians 6, verses 10 through 18? There are 7 elements of armor, and Paul twice admonishes you to put on the whole armor, not just your favorite pieces, all 7 pieces. What are they? What do those idioms represent? Well, he's drawing analogies from a soldier that's chained to him. No, he's not. That's commonly taught. Now, those idioms are in the Old Testament. He's quoting from Isaiah. For several of them. The reason the centurion is chained to him is so the centurion can't get away. Can you imagine being chained to Paul for a full shift? Most of them came to the Lord. That's referred to in the Philippian letter, the household of Caesar. Well, that's what it's talking about. You have a family priesthood. Do you have it established? Are you active in it? Do you officiate? If not, shame on you. That's a requirement for the Lord. Small group studies. We've probably covered that. And what are your self-sufficiency goals? Do you want to be self-sufficient? I don't mean just financially in general. What are your goals? Make them quantitative. Measure them. Have a program to get to wherever you think you want to get. And that includes health surveillance and maintenance. Homeschooling discoveries. The only form of schooling, by the way, in the Bible is homeschooling. I don't want to put a guilt trip on anybody, but, you know, that's why many of us live in Idaho, because they encourage homeschooling. And the statistics are stunning if you've done any homework in that world. And, of course, we have resources that we won't tell you about. Well, that leads me to the most important factor of all. And what is the fourth factor of our little four-step program? Learn the supernatural elements of stewardship. Wow, are there supernatural elements? Absolutely. This is the solution to all financial problems. Let's take a look. What are man's purposes for money? Well, to provide for security. That's your wife will agree with that very immediately. Establish independence. That's the guy's dream there. Create power and influence. Well, let's contrast man's conception with God's conception. The focus of man is power and position. God's way is to be submissive to Him. Put yourself in reliance on Him, not self-sufficiency. What's the emphasis? Ours is rights and freedoms, right? At one time, we had a nation founded on that idea. God's way is personal responsibility. Desire, we have gain for self. God's way is to have your money, use of money is to meet the needs of others. Boy, there's no greater joy than to reach out to someone who's really hurting and be able to do something for them. What a joy that is. Concern. Our concern is our immediate fulfillment. We're a have-it-now generation, right? God's way is to invest in lasting achievements. Notice each one of these is antithetical to the other. The yearning, man's yearning is for the praise of men, and of course, God's way is to get approval of God. Those are not necessarily the same things. Man aspires to be served, and God is, his aspiration for you is to serve others. The people who are the most happiest in their lives and who have discovered a way they can really meaningfully serve others. And man's need is to push ahead, but God's way is to teach you patience. That's our often prayer. Lord, I want patience. I'm praying for patience, and I want it now, you know. We strive to lead men, and God's way is to follow God. And our interest is competition, God's way is cooperation. So they're very antithetical all the way through the list. Motivation of the one is self-glorification, and of course, obviously, the others are God's glory. So we begin to sense there's a total antithetical aspect of stewardship from God's point of view. God's purpose of money are for provision, for direction, for fellowship, and demonstrating His glory. And we can go through all kinds of examples, each one of these, to provide our basic needs, deepen our love, develop a spirit of gratefulness. These are all pretty straightforward platitudes, if you will, that are well-defined throughout the epistles. To confirm direction, to build our faith and vision, to determine who is the real Lord of your life, to protect us from harmful life. Often we should thank God for the prayers He didn't answer. Every time you go to a high school reunion, you probably can utter that thing, right? All right, you read me, okay. He teaches patience, concentrate on true riches, and so forth. And to give it to others, to unite Christians, to demonstrate the mark of a Christian, to initiate spontaneous thanksgiving, and to multiply the potential for giving, and so forth. And to illustrate God's power, to cause other Christians to trust Him, to mock the false gods of our age, to purify our motives, to bring non-Christians to salvation, to glorify God. All these there, and they're all on the internet if you want to dig those up. Tithing, God's direct challenge. It's amazing that the God of the universe will put Himself in a box. You don't test God, and just as there's one exception. He challenges you to challenge Him. And that's, of course, in the area of tithing in Malachi 3, 8 through 10. And by the way, tithing was instituted before the law. So let's not go down that path. There are four reasons for tithing. It acknowledges the Creator's rights. One-tenth are His in the first place. When you give Him a tenth, you're not giving Him, you're just giving Him back that which is His in the first place. And it's also the antidote for greed and covetousness. Tithing is the antidote to covetousness. And it's operative that way. It's also a test of our faith, and it's the solution to every financial problem you have. That's the challenge. That's not my challenge. That's God's challenge in Malachi 3. Read it. And it's also the Old Testament pattern all through the Old Testament. Don't have to nail that one down. But it's also confirmed in the New Testament. Christ has not set aside tithes in Matthew 23. It's implied in the even so of 1 Corinthians 9. It's the lay by him in store in 1 Corinthians 16. And that alludes, of course, to a number of other passages. So we go on and on about this. I assume that you guys have teachings in your church. You have a posture and all that stuff. But tithing is even more binding on us since our privileges are greater. For unto whomsoever much is given, of him much is required. Boy, that pinches every one of us. A tenth of all is his. So be strict, be careful, be systematic, keep records. Separate funds upon arrival is a smart play. I remember when we were first married, we did that, my wife and I. We set up a separate checking account. We didn't care about interest. We just made it a simple checking account. That was the Lord's account. And when stuff came in, we took one-tenth and put it in that account. We later would decide how to spend it out of that account. But we made it very systematic and so forth. Keep records. Your giving only comes after the return of his tenth, by the way, if you want to be technical about it. But there's another concept that I learned as a professional manager, which I call the portfolio management concept of giving. And professional managers tend to minimize their maximum regret. That's called the Savage Principle in decision theory. What they basically do, they live quarter by quarter, and they want to make decisions so at the end of the quarter, it will minimize their regret. Okay? The regret being that whatever they've achieved versus what they might have achieved, they want to minimize that factor. And so they make decisions in terms of how they think it'll look at the end of the quarter or at the end of the year. Okay? So they're always operating against that report card. They make their decisions in the light of the ultimate review at the end of the reporting period. So what does that mean? If you're on a board of a church and you have people coming for handouts, you don't give simply relying on apparent need. Why? Because there's more needs than you can possibly deal with. In our culture, on a global culture, that's obviously just even true right here in our own horizon. There's more need than you can possibly deal with. So what criteria do you use? You look for evidence that God is in the action. Because you're not responding to need. You want to be investing where you know God is blessing it. You look for evidence of God's blessing. Their need alone isn't enough. It took me a while to pick up on what the professionals were doing here. And when they would interrogate someone who was coming up for a proposal of some kind, what they were really looking for is their evidence God is in the action. Because then we want to invest with him. Okay? You follow me? And so that's the winning strategy. And by the way, they say you can't take it with you. Yes, you can. That's a lie. You can take it with you. You know how you do that? You send it up ahead. You send it up ahead, okay? If you were going to Algeria, to get into Algeria, you have to spend 3 days in Paris to get a visa. So that's a great strategy to, if you're going to win a bet on a dinner, the loser pays the restaurant. You pick the El Janina restaurant in Algiers because the guy will have to pay for you to spend 3 days in Paris to get the visa to get to the Algiers. Anyway, the point is, what you do, though, if you're going to Algeria, you get your money converted to Algerian dinar before you get there. See, what you do is you convert your currency in advance. Well, that's the same thing you do in heaven. Convert your currency in advance. Send it up ahead, okay? And how do you do that? By applying it here to benefit them. You spend it now so that you get credit for it at the Bema Seat. That's really the concept I'm suggesting here. So we do have a final exam. It's the Bema Seat of Christ. We've been through all that. That's the first act in heaven, I believe, after the Harpazo. We'll all give a stewardship accounting for our fruit bearing. The results will determine whether we'll be making up the bride, whether we'll attend the marriage supper, who will receive crowns, rewards, and so forth. Not everyone will attend the marriage supper. That's a privilege to a selected, restricted few. That's what the wedding guest is about. By the way, he wasn't unsaved. He was saved, but he just didn't have the right garment because he wasn't eligible for that participation. That's a privilege, not to everyone. And who will reign with him and so forth. Anyway, getting back to the final challenge for this weekend, what's your action plan, guys? What's God calling you to do? Find out what it is and get at it. And have that include an intensified, systematic study of the Word of God. So, okay, now we've talked about our thing. I won't go through all that again. I am going to encourage you to think about getting in the program and getting a bronze. And I'll warn you in advance, if you get a bronze medallion, you'll find that's addictive. It's so much fun, you'll be hooked to get go on to your silver and gold medallions and what have you. And you, of course, can get involved as a volunteer in a number of different ways, and I won't spend more time on that. We've talked about that. And we've talked so much about nuclear weapons and all kinds of topics. I didn't want to close on that. We'll have a Q&A after this, but I wanted to. I made the crack earlier that I'm not a Republican or a Democrat. I'm a monarchist. And somebody asked me, what did I mean by that? You know, I often get invited to officiate at a governor's prayer breakfast. And they never invite me back the second time. Okay. Because I make that very point, that I'm not a Republican or a Democrat. I'm a monarchist. And I say, okay, let me tell you about my candidate, coming king, because he is a king of the Jews. He's Jewish. Yes, he's a racial king. That shocks many people. He's also a national king. He is the king of Israel. But he's also king of all the ages, king of heaven, king of glory, and king of kings, and Lord of lords. And the question for everyone, the overriding question tonight is, do you know him? I mean, do you really know him? He was a prophet before Moses, a priest after Melchizedek, a champion like Joshua, an offering in the place of Isaac, a wise counselor. He was king from the line of David, a wise counselor even above Solomon. He was beloved, then rejected, and then exalted son like Joseph, yet far more than that. The heavens declare his glory. The firmament shows his handiwork. He who is and who was and always will be, the first and the last, the Alpha and the Omega, the Aleph and the Tau, or in our language, the A and the Z. He's the first fruits of them that slept. He's the Ego Ami, the Ichyach Asher Ichyach. Yes, he is the voice of the burning. He's the I am that I am. He's the voice of the burning bush. Yes, and he also was the captain of the Lord's host. He was the conqueror of Jericho. Read the last verses of chapter 5. He's enduringly strong, entirely sincere, eternally steadfast. He's immortally graceful, imperially powerful, impartially merciful. That's our king. In him dwells the fullness of the Godhead bodily, the very God of very God. He's our kinsman redeemer, right? But turn that coin over. He's also our avenger of blood. I love these bumper stickers. Jesus is coming soon, and boy, is he angry. Some of them are a little more graphic than that. I'll leave that alone. The latest one someone gave me was that Jesus is not coming to take sides. He's coming to take over. I like that. He's our city of refuge. He's our performing high priest, our personal prophet, our reigning king. He's the loftiest idea in literature. He's the highest personality in philosophy. He's the fundamental doctrine of theology. He's the supreme problem in higher criticism. And he's the miracle of the ages, the superlative of everything good. You and I are the beneficiaries of a love letter that was written in blood on a wooden cross erected in Judea some 2,000 years ago. He was crucified on a cross of wood, they say. Crucified on a cross of wood, and yet he made the hill on which it stood. By him were all things made that were made, and without him was not anything made that was made. And by him are all things held together. Ooh. What held him to that cross? It wasn't the nails. At any time he could have said, enough already, I'm out of here. What held him to that cross? His love for you and me kept him there. And by the way, the love of the Father allowed that. The Father loved you so much that he allowed his Son to go through that humiliation and that torture and that mission. Why? Because he loves you too, more than you have any capacity to imagine. He was born of a woman so that we could be born of God. He humbled himself so that we could be lifted up. He became a servant so that we could be made joint heirs with him. We have no capacity to imagine what that means. He suffered rejection so that we could become his friends. He denied himself so that we could freely receive all things. He gave himself so that he could bless us in every way. Wow. He's available to the tempted and tried. He blesses the young. He cleanses the lepers. He defends the feeble. He delivers the captives. He discharges the debtors. He forgives the sinners. He franchises the meek. He guards the besieged. He heals the sick. He provides strength to the weak. He regards the aged. He rewards the diligent. He sympathizes and he serves the unfortunate. He sympathizes and he saves. His offices are manifold. His reign is righteous. His promises are sure. You know, it's interesting. Let me just pause here for an example. The Quran presents Allah that he can do anything, anytime. In fact, he's presented as being capricious. Read that untrustworthy. The God of Abraham, Yitzhak, and Yaakov delights in making and keeping his promises. I want you to notice that the presentation of Allah in the Quran and the presentation of the God of the Bible are opposites even as they're presented. No, his promises are sure. His goodness is limitless. His light is matchless. His grace is sufficient. His love never changes. His mercy is everlasting. His word is enough. His yoke is easy and his burden is light. I wish I could describe him to you. He's indescribable. He's incomprehensible. He's irresistible. He's invincible. The heaven of heavens cannot contain him. Man cannot explain him. The Pharisees couldn't stand him and soon learned they couldn't stop him. Pilate could not, the personal representative of the ruler of the world, could not find any fault with him. The witnesses could not agree against him. Herod could not kill him. Death couldn't handle him. The grave couldn't hold him. He has always been and always will be. He had no predecessor and he'll have no successor. You can't impeach him, and he ain't going to resign. His name is above every name. That at the name of Yeshua, every knee shall bow, and every tongue shall confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. His is the kingdom, the power, and the glory for ever and ever. Amen. God bless you.
Thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. 1,000 times, thank you. Chuck, unfortunately, because of time, we're going to have to hold off a little bit on the Q&A section in the evening. But we hope that you'll be able to join us. We have a bonfire scheduled this evening at 10 o'clock.
Okay.
And we hope that, just once again, let's thank them.
Okay.
What an amazing day of information.
Thank
you so much for coming. So if you guys could just remain standing if you would like, Kenny just brings us into a song. And Chuck, we hope you'll be able to stay with us into the wee hours of the evening as much as you would like. And those of you who may have questions, you could approach him as he may be available later on in the evening. But thank you again for coming. And thank you for just spending this day with us.
Call me a sinner, poor and needy, weak and wounded, sick and sore. Jesus ready, stands to save you, full of pity, love and power. Call me thirsty. Come and welcome God's free bounty, glorified. True belief is true repentance, and every grace that brings God. I will rise and go, Jesus. He will embrace me in his arms. And in the arms of my dear Savior, there